assistance provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through National Public Radio's Satellite Program Development Fund. The program was produced by Benjamin Shapiro, who is solely responsible for its content.
We'll hear the final program from the Independent Eyes series featuring filmmaker Les Blank sometime in the near future here on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. It's 7 minutes after 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. At 5 o'clock today, we'll be joining National Public Radio for All Things Considered. This evening on All Things Considered, a report on President Reagan's appointment of a troubleshooter for Central America. Also, NPR's Cokie Roberts has a story on possible compromises between the administration and Congress on the sticky issue of aid to Nicaragua's Contra rebels. And memories of artist Georgia O'Keeffe, that's later at 5 o'clock on All Things Considered. Well, more on documentary film now. With me is Emile D'Antonio, who's one of this country's leading leftist documentary filmmakers. He describes himself as an American Marxist. Most of his films analyze power in America. His first film, Point of Order, is a documentary about Joe McCarthy using footage from the Army-McCarthy hearings. His 1971 film Millhouse, a white comedy, takes an ironic look at Richard Nixon's career by juxtaposing news footage and excerpts of TV broadcasts. The film landed D'Antonio on Nixon's enemies list, and he had the distinction of being the only filmmaker on it. In The Year of the Pig, released in 1969, is a history of the war in Vietnam from the French colonization to America's Tet Offensive in 1968. In 1975, D'Antonio made the film Underground, featuring secretly shot interviews with members of the radical group The Weather Underground. The government subpoenaed the footage. D'Antonio and his colleagues refused to hand it over, and the subpoena was eventually withdrawn. His latest film, released in 1982, called In the King of Prussia, stars Martin Sheen and the members of the Plowshares Eight in a recreation of the trial of eight peace activists. One of D'Antonio's best-known films is Painter's Painting, which features interviews with some of the most influential artists of our time, including Frank Stella, Willem de Kooning, Andy Warhol, and Robert Rauschenberg. D'Antonio was given a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art Film Department in 1979. His films have shown at repertory theaters for many years. Several have recently been given a new life through their release on video cassette. Tomorrow evening, his film about Vietnam and the Year of the Pig will be shown at the International House, and he'll be there to speak at the screening. That's tomorrow at 7 o'clock in the evening at the International House, 3701 Chestnut Street. For more information, you can call 387-5125, extension 222. That's 387-5125, extension 222. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You know, in a letter you wrote to me, you said something very cryptic. You said that television destroys memory.
Oh, it does. We're inundated with television in this country. I mean, think of the way children grow up. They look, they stare at that set, and millions of images are bombard them every day, every week. What are these images? They're meretricious images. They're images without any redeeming value in most cases. They're images that displace you in time. The New York Times recently, for instance, carried a piece about the fact that kids can't tell time or don't understand time because they read it on a digital clock. Very young kids can run a computer, but they don't know anything about 5th century Greek history or the history of their own country or what Ronald Reagan is doing. There are no value judgments. It's a technical life or else you're excluded.
What did you want to do with your movies that was different from what other filmmakers were doing and also different from what television was doing?
Well, I felt that there was a kind of shallow aestheticism in film in which people were looking for beautiful images. And reality isn't like that. And so I thought, and this does come out of people like Rauschenberg and John Cage, I thought with my first film, why don't I take something that was maybe one of the most important things in American life, but yet that was ugly, basically ugly, badly shot, kinescope material. And this, I got hold of, by spending a lot of money, the complete Army-McCarthy hearings, which ran from April to June 1954. It was one of the greatest events in the history of television. You couldn't do that anymore. And it was a unique event because television did something that it never did before. It destroyed a demagogue, McCarthy was absolutely destroyed. When those hearings began, he was one of the most powerful men in the country in April. When you get to June 16, he's finished. I mean, because for once, people had a chance to see somebody all the time. They saw him drunk. They saw him lying. They saw him callously lying. And his audience hasn't vanished because people like Bill Buckley and Roy Cohn and Ronald Reagan still have a soft spot in their hearts for Joe McCarthy because he's one of the great demons of the right wing, after all. But the idea in my film was to take dead, inert material, old kinescopes, and it isn't editing. It has to do with structure. It has to do with making something that wasn't there. It has to do with making a sense that the real event did not have, because the real event was 188 hours. It was so big that it didn't have any sense. And it was imposing a kind of artistic structure over it. And it was a collage, basically, a collage of images and voices.
That's a technique that you also used in a later film, Millhouse, a white comedy, for which you took news footage and television speeches, and you wove that together, too. And you juxtaposed the footage in such a way so that it was pretty ironic in many points. Did you think that in that instance, that irony would be a good tool to help deflate his reputation?
Well, I think that was the point. I mean, I made Millhouse a white comedy before Watergate. So Nixon was riding high. He was coming into the 72 elections, which he was about to win hugely. In fact, by a greater majority than anybody's ever won an election in this country. And I thought he had to be deflated because I thought that what he was doing was, at the very least, it was uninteresting. And at the worst, too many people were dying. It wasn't just Vietnam. And there was something wrong in his administration, the kind of people who were around him, as in the case of Reagan. People like Haldeman and Ehrlichman, John Dean, those weren't the kind of people one was accustomed to see in a White House, even White Houses you disagreed with. So I wanted to sort of put that under a sharp satirical probe. When the film came out, it was amazing because people who did satirical work in other art forms all jumped on and said, this is fantastic. Philip Roth, even Andy Warhol, they all immediately produced blurbs that the Times ran because it is a very funny film. I call it Millhouse a white comedy, and it is a comedy. But it's a sad comedy because it's my country, and this is my country. I may be a Marxist, but I love this country. It's my space. I can afford to live anywhere. And I occupy this space because it's mine. I'd like to change it. It doesn't mean I don't love it. I think I loved it better than Nixon does or better than J. Edgar Hoover did.
I wonder what your attitudes are toward Nixon, many people who were just very hostile toward him during the war in Vietnam have softened in some ways watching him age and watching him living almost in exile.
I'm a fairly tough person. I hate my enemies, old or young, dead or alive. I have no forgiveness for Nixon. I cannot forgive the man who, with Kissinger, ordered the Christmas bombing. Those were acts of extraordinary inhumanity. I think that the funniest thing that ever happened in American life was giving Nixon the Nobel Peace Prize. He should have something else should have happened.
Well, Vietnam was actually the subject of one of your movies, In the Year of the Pig, which you made in 1969. Let me just read here a quote from Pauline Kael, who reviewed the film in The New Yorker. She said, Emile D'Antonio has made a strong film that does what American television has failed to do. It provides an historical background and puts the events into an intelligible framework. And indeed, what you were doing in the movie was providing a historical context for what was happening in Vietnam, and part of what you used was television news footage.
Well, it's also that history is interesting stuff, I mean, the raw material of history is much more interesting than soap operas, and that's what TV was giving us. When television went on the air about itself and beat its breast and said, this war is being covered in a way that no war was ever covered, I knew it was a lie, and I knew it was one of the reasons my film had to be made. And the reason it was a lie is if every night on TV, I have a Marine Corps sergeant setting fire to a Vietnamese hut, or you have an American soldier dying in combat, or planes dropping bombs, or whatever the horrors are on both sides, people get accustomed to this. And then when they're sandwiched between commercials, it's just like everything else. You know, suddenly nobody says anything about this on TV. Nobody said anything about these things on TV. Nobody said, why are these things happening? When is this going to end? Who the hell are these people? Why are we bombing them? And who are they? Where do they come from? I mean, nobody knew where. When the Vietnam War began, nobody could have found Vietnam with a pointer. Nobody had ever heard of any Vietnamese person. So I wanted to put everything in a context. My film begins with rare footage. I'm a very good researcher. The networks would never find this stuff until I did. I found images of Vietnamese pulling French soldiers in a rickshaw. I found, you know, a kind of material. Eisenstein tried to do this, and he's one of my heroes. I'm not particularly pro-Soviet, but Eisenstein was a great filmmaker in the early days. The whole point of this idea is that images can do history better than long written texts, and particularly if you're prejudiced. Prejudiced history is the only true history because objective history doesn't exist. I mean, I can't be objective about Nixon or Joe McCarthy or the war in Vietnam or racism or Ronald Reagan. I mean, I have opinions about all of those subjects. If I were to pretend I did not have them, as people on TV do, I'd be a liar. And I'm subjective. But on the other hand, my work is seen. It's seen all over the world. People can judge it. They can say, here's where D'Antonio lies. But nobody's ever, as much as Roy Cohn and Buckley have attacked me in the press, they've never found a place where they could say, in the McCarthy film, this is where he lied. This is where he faked it. Because Roy Cohn went through that whole experience. He was in my film. And I asked Roy, who is dying now, as you know, I asked Roy in 1972 to do an introduction of a book I was doing on Point of Order, and he did. And the whole thing is an attack on me, which I didn't mind at all, but then he said, and finally I must say that everything that that D'Antonio did, which I detest, I must say he did brilliantly.
You were talking about how television, you know, didn't provide the historical context, and it was just seeing violence every night, and you can feel immune to that after a while. I wonder what you thought of the public television series Vietnam, A Television History, which presented itself as being an objective journalistic historical account of the war in Vietnam, but was attacked by groups on the right for being having too much of a liberal bias. What did you think of that series? Did you think that was successful in terms of presenting the war in Vietnam and successful television?
I think it was... three things. I mean, A, it was dishonest in that it obviously took material that I had found and I was never given any credit for it because nobody else had ever seen that material. In the second place, it was shallow in spite of the fact that they did it for 12 hours. In assuming a liberal position, they simply flattened out history. They took the rage out. That was when they treated the movement in this country. If you were alive in the 60s and early 70s, you've never seen rage. There's no history of such rage among young people. And they had, this was in the film, but it was emasculated, you know. The reason for that rage wasn't in the film. The history of Vietnam itself was flat. And there's a kind of bizarre story, which is point number three. The producer of that film, of that series of films, is somebody I've known a long time, maybe longer than anybody I know. When I came out of the Army in 1945, he was coming out of the Merchant Marine, and we met in New York. So when he began that film for PBS, he came to see me. I have a lot of books. Before I made my film, I read 250 books on Vietnam, and I have them all in my library in French and English. And so he said to me, Dee, can we borrow these books? And I said, no, you can't. Send a secretary here to copy the titles down, and you can do it for $500. I said, no, you're going to go out and raise it. And you're not going to. I mean, it took me a long time to find these books. I had to read them all and think about them. So I have this check signed by the production company that did the film, for not even for using the books, but just for coming in and copying the titles. They would have had to hire a researcher who would have charged them $500 a day.
Well, you know, this raises a very interesting question to me. People in journalism or in filmmaking are very protective of their sources and of their information, because your information is your art in a lot of ways, you know. The information you've collected is what you're going to use for your movies or your program or whatever. And now, on the one hand, you're a Marxist who believes in a certain kind of equitable distribution of materials and goods. And on the other hand, you're kind of protecting your sources and your material.
I wasn't protecting
from
my sources. I knew what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I knew they were going to have $3 million worth of funding or whatever it was they had, they did have. So I thought that they might as well pay me. The $500 is a token. I don't need that kind of money. But why not? In addition to inventing a new film form, even within the Year of the Pig, which was a collage of history, not one event, but and I did a lot of shooting of people all over the world. But in addition to that, I created a new way of fundraising, which I really liked. I knew a wealthy woman who was violently against the war, and she said, "Dee, I'll do anything I can to help you." And I said, "Good. I'll give you the title of executive producer. I want you to give one party a week. I can raise the money easily," I said, "from two or three people. But I want to go out and make a political talk once a week to raise money." So she invited everybody you've ever heard of, from Abby Rockefeller to Richard Avedon to famous fashion models, actresses, Hollywood people, stockbrokers on Wall Street, big lawyers. And I would speak, and they would all write checks. And I was attempting to politicize people while I was raising the money. So I never had a whole budget at one time the way you do it ordinarily in film or in Hollywood or in TV. I'd raise $50,000, $40,000, and then I'd go out and start once a week talking, lecturing, hectoring, never begging. But in a sense, I've said many times that the independent producer and director is always a con man as well as an artist. I mean, you've got to find the bread. And you don't want to lie, so you have to be a very special kind of con man. You have to be a con man for the truth. But yet you have to be charming, engaging, convincing, historically minded, so you can tell people something they don't know, because they don't want to be bored with the headline in today's New York Times. So in that way, I mean, I used to begin talks by saying, the history of Vietnam really begins, this is true, by the way, in 222 BC. That's the earliest record of it, when the Chinese under the Han Dynasty invaded it. And then I would start talking about the Han Dynasty. It's sort of helpful to be an intellectual when you do this kind of thing. Then I had a great feminist thing, which was also true and very something that the Vietnamese are so proud of, and it's how dumb our people in Vietnam were. There were two great Vietnamese women, 40 AD, called the Trung Sisters. And they actually fought as leaders of troops against the Chinese. You know about them?
No.
They fought against the Chinese, and they won a couple of victories, and then they were defeated. And rather than surrender, they just rode their horses off of cliffs and died. So when Madame Nu, the wife of Ngo Dinh Diem, who was the person we were supporting, put statues of herself up all over, it was as if she were they. So when the government fell, when Ngo Dinh Diem was assassinated and his government fell, the people went out in the streets and pulled all those statues down, because the people knew where their history was, and it wasn't in our side, and it wasn't in the side of Ngo Dinh Diem and Madame Nu and the crooked news.
So do you think you won minds or got a lot of money through this technique of...
Well, yeah, I got all the money to make the film.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of money.
The film we're talking about, by the way, in the Year of the Pig, will be shown tomorrow evening at the International House in West Philadelphia, and that's at 3701 Chestnut Street, and that's tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, and Emile D'Antonio will be there to speak about it. The film was made in 1968 or 69?
It was made through 67 and 8, and it was really released at the very end of 68, beginning of 69. Could I interrupt you just
sure.
One thing, Terry?
Yeah.
I never speak in front of my films, and I don't give speeches after them. What I like to do is engage the audience. Anybody who comes can ask any question, and I will, not that I know the answer, but I will attempt to answer. I love the dialectic process. I love give and take. And I find this is the best way, the most honest way I can deal with an audience. If I've had Vietnam vets come when I speak and get very, very excited and angry. And that doesn't bother me either. People, if you have an intense emotional experience, you have every right to be excited and angry. And but I'm there to defend the work and the history I believe in.
Okay. Another film that you did that engaged the government and you in a bit of a battle was Underground, and it was very secretive interviews that you did with members of the Weather Underground, and they were underground at the time. You had to hide out and do the interviews. And I don't know how much you can tell about this, but how did you get their cooperation, participation in the movie?
Well, it was obviously a long, complicated process because, as you say, they were underground. The FBI had been looking for them. Probably the biggest FBI task force of all time over a period of time, from 1969 to 1975 when I filmed them. There were hundreds and hundreds of FBI men looking for these people. They couldn't find them. So the FBI went crazy, of course, when a middle-aged filmmaker found them and was able to live underground with them for a few days and film them and then come out and start talking about releasing the film. The FBI responded by forcing the Assistant Attorney General of the United States in California into subpoenaing Mary Lamson, Haskell Wexler, and myself, the three of us who worked on the film. We took what we considered an ethical position under the First Amendment of the Constitution, which I believe in for everybody, which was that we had the right to make any damn film we wanted. And when we said that, something clicked in Hollywood because everybody came forward, because people, conservative people I knew, like Peter Bogdanovich, could see that at some point if they could tamper with a radical, they could tamper with anybody. So we had every major Hollywood name, including the heads of the unions, stood behind me when I read a statement, which is we ask the support to make any film we want, which is the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. And that's what those people supported. It was, Warren Beatty and Shirley MacLaine, and it's where I met and became a friend of Martin Sheen. He was there, and John Voight, and many, many people, hundreds. The government was awed by that. We're the only people who ever won in the whole history of the film industry. The government withdrew the subpoenas, and we went on to make the film. Of course, the FBI tried to break into my house, tried to break into my studio. It subjected me to Elsur and Fissure. Fissure is spelled F-I-S-U-R and means physical surveillance, and Elsur is E-L-U-S-U-R, means electronic surveillance. Those were the treats and the rewards for living the life I led and doing the work I do.
Were you worried during the making of the movie that that the FBI would come pounding the door down as you were shooting, that they'd find you?
We were all worried about that. Every one of us was, because we had had the precedent only a year before in Los Angeles of radicals trapped in a house. And I saw the complete film of that at the Sherman Grimberg Film Library. It was about an hour's worth of film. It was stuff that never went on TV.
It was the SLA shootout.
The SLA shootout in L.A., in which literally police tanks were brought into position and firebombs, as in Philadelphia, were used. And these people never had a chance to surrender or anything. They were just killed. And there were some L.A. cops who claimed that two of the women who were killed tried to crawl out to surrender, and the order was given to shoot them at once. They didn't want anybody to surrender. You have stuff like that in Philadelphia, after all. But that was in our minds. We knew that if the L.A. police in particular had surrounded that house, we would have had a slim chance, I think.
How much can you tell about how you were able to do this without anybody getting onto it?
I'm not kidding. For the first time, I can tell you how it happened. I had a young guy working for me who is now the editor of the Village Voice. His name is Robert Friedman. And he knew some people from Columbia Days, where some very strong members of the Weather Underground were. And one day I said to him, one thing I'd really like to do is get in touch with those guys and see if you could make a film underground. He said, I think that might be vaguely possible. I said, how could that be possible? He said, let me put a feeler out. So About a week later, he said, remember that talk we had? I said, about what? He said, you know, about the Weather Underground? I said, yeah, why? He said, well, they don't know. I said, what do you mean they don't know? He said, somebody's been in touch with them. I can't tell you anything. I said, really? He said, but if you were to write down everything you had in mind, I could get it to them. I thought, this is too wild. It's like writing an application to do something, or else doing a tentative script, just like in Hollywood. Here's a 5-page version of the story. See how it plays. So I just sat down one night with too much to drink and just typed it 5 pages out, single-spaced, about why I wanted to do it, why I thought it'd be good for them, and what I had in mind, the kind of film. And I said I wanted to use stock footage. I wanted to place them in history. I was fascinated with them because I knew it was the end of something, you see. And it was a terminal process in the history of the 60s. It was the end of it by the time I filmed them. Here you were, I mean, to use that terrible phrase of Halberstam's, these were the best and the brightest. These were upper-class white kids, most of them. They weren't kids by the time I filmed them, but they began in their teens. They were upper-class white kids. They were fearless. They bombed. They put a bomb in the Senate. They put a bomb in a police station in New York. I mean, you know, wild stuff, and nobody could catch them. So you had a combination of everything, a police story, revolutionaries, and yet it was the end, you know. And when you and I spoke, you know, you hit it on the button. They still won't recognize us, that they were so rigid in their doctrine. And the reason people are rigid in doctrine is because they don't know it. They hadn't read enough left stuff. We had tremendous arguments about lifestyle. You know, they said, oh, it's because you're a different generation, Dee. I said, well, of course I'm a different generation, but I don't think that LSD is political. They said, oh, it's a tremendous political drug. And I said, nonsense, you know, I mean.
Well, when I was watching the movie, I was just really amazed at how they were speaking rhetoric. They didn't seem to really want to talk about themselves or about the genesis of their ideas or say anything very original. It was as if they had all read the same text and digested it and could spit it back out again.
Well, I broke that in the film, though. If you remember in the film, I said to Kathy Boudin, I said, look, Kathy, this is what people want to know, why you, a middle-class young American woman who went to Bryn Mawr, who you know, had every advantage in life, what are you doing here underground with me? And then she talked about going to Cuba. She talked about her father, the famous left lawyer, Leonard Boudin. And then they all started to talk, and that opened it up. And that helped the picture, of course.
Don't you think it was, in a way, the dirty secret of the left of that period, that so many of the leaders on the left were from middle-class, upper-middle-class, or even upper-class families?
And
people had real difficulty, who were in that position, admitting to that.
They did, because they didn't know enough history. I mean, Engels went riding did fox hunting in England. He supported Marx. Marx and Engels both made a killing in the stock on the money exchanges during the American Civil War. Not only did they write articles for Horace Greeley, but they knew the North was going to win, so they sold the Confederate dollar short, which is a very prudent and intelligent thing to do, and they made money out of it. Fidel Castro, after all, comes from the upper classes of Cuba. Ho Chi Minh was the son of a mandarin. Mao was he wasn't a mandarin or a general or anything like that, but he came from a family that was well off enough so that he had an education. People whose faces are brutishly pushed into the ground don't frequently get a chance to have ideas and to express them and have the time to think them out and to organize and do all the rest of it. I think that there's no doubt this is why the FBI and the government hated the Weather people so much, because they were of privilege. They were people of privilege. I mean, FBI men didn't come from that background.
But do you think the people in the Weather Underground were embarrassed for some reason to admit to their past, to admit to the privilege that they were from because they opposed privilege?
They were, and this was a mistake, you know. And in the film, it helped that point came out. It's an important point. You have to be truthful about who you are. Jeff Jones, whom I admire tremendously, he's the only one who came from a working-class background. I mean, his father was when they were still underground in the film, and I was given the award of the American Civil Liberties Union in L.A., and I went out to receive the award. This man I'd never seen before, an older man, came up to me and he said, I'd like to talk to you, please. And I said, sure, I mean, you know, I'm getting this award. And he said, yeah, yeah, when it's over. He said, I'm Jeff Jones's father, and I embraced him. And he said, how is Jeff? And I said, well, you know, I have seen him since I shot him in the film. He's wonderful. He's absolutely, I'd be proud of him if I were you. He said, I am. And Jeff liked nature, which I used to shoot birds and love birds. That's one of those terrible dichotomies in male life when you're brought up the way I was and you're my age. But Jeff said, you know, once when I was sort of running along the Hollywood Hills underground, he said, I saw a fox in the moonlight. He says, the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. And I said, you know that I once, when I came out of swimming in the ocean in the Atlantic, I was walking through some briars and a little pine clump, and I saw a red-tailed fox. And it was one of the great moments of my life, because you don't see many foxes here, you know, in the East. And so we talked about foxes and birds, and he's an amazing man. I like him very much.
You know, we were talking about the idea of a lot of people on the left and a lot of, like, the leading radicals and revolutionaries being actually from privileged backgrounds. I mean, you yourself are probably in your own way an example of that, because you're a radical and your father was a doctor and I think ran a hospital or something.
Well, he and another doctor owned a hospital, yeah.
Yeah. So have you been comfortable with that, or is that something that...
It's never bothered me in the slightest. Mm-hmm. I live a very simple life. This is the only jacket I own, and I bought it in a secondhand store. I mean, I can afford to have a suit made, but it doesn't interest me. I live in the East Village where I've always lived. Now it's become chic and expensive. I can't help that. But my tastes, I have two tastes that are expensive that I indulge. One is books. No matter what a book costs, I buy it. And I like good liquor and wine. But basically, I don't spend money on anything. I like good dinners. But I'm not interested in all that other stuff. I don't have a car. I don't need a car in New York. I don't want a car. I don't desire things, which is a difference between people of my class. And I don't want to own objects. Because objects end up by owning you. I mean, it's a cliche to say that, but it's true. I'd rather read a book than see most of the fancy people I knew when I was at Harvard or something like that.
Do you think it's easier to reject that kind of privilege and that kind of obsession with things and consumerism once you've had the opportunity to have it? You can just say you don't want it.
I think it's easier to give it up than not to have had it at all. I mean, I think that the most impressive man I ever knew, ever, was I don't know what his real name was. He was a German seaman. I was 16 or 17 years old. I was in my first year at Harvard. I entered at 16, as I said. And he was the one who converted me to Marxism. I mean, I noticed the difference, the similarity between him, say, and the Berrigans. He lived in a space that's half the size of this studio room. And he had, you know, two shirts, one pair of trousers. He had no vices, and he believed that social change was necessary and that his life was, he was young. I mean, I was 16, he was 28, 27. But he made me feel that I was inadequate. You know, we talked about the world, how to change it. As Marx said, the idea is not to understand the world, but to change it. And he brought that home to me. He moved through the Harvard community. He converted quite a few people. He was extraordinary.
Do you or do other people ever feel that it's incompatible to have a lot of money and be a Marxist? Because I think that's one of the reasons why people who come from privileged backgrounds and who end up being Marxists or leftists are uncomfortable about it, because it seems irreconcilable to them that they'd have this duty to divide up evenly everything they had with other people who had less.
Well, in the 30s, you see, the communist movement in this country was a legitimate American movement. So it had a lot of poor people and a lot of working class people. There isn't any communist party now that matters. And I belong to a good many left-wing groups. I'm on the board of a couple. The chairman of one of the boards of these things is a very old man. His father was the head of J.P. Morgan and Company. I mean, he himself at this age, in his advanced years, can write a check for more money than most people will see in many years. But Marxism isn't corrupted by that. Marxism is corrupted by inertia, by the fact that Marxism is corrupted by Stalin. Marxism is corrupted by the lack of movement and freedom. That's what corrupts it. If Marxism should be able to forgive anybody's past. If you do well and think well and do your best, that's all anybody can expect. I mean, this is true of religion, and it's true of serious politics. You don't question John Reed was an interesting person. He came from a wealthy background.
You've worked with Haskell Wexler, who also
comes from a wealthy background,
right.
Is a Marxist.
Mm-hmm. And he's a Hollywood cinematographer.
He's an extremely successful Hollywood cinematographer. He's won a couple of Academy Awards, and one with Elizabeth Taylor, and who's afraid of Virginia Woolf. He also has a fairly substantial commercials company. He made commercials with John Wayne, which everybody who knew both John Wayne and Haskell thought was funny. I mean, here you had the left and the right.
Did you ever feel, working closely with him, that you wished that you were part of that Hollywood scene, not just for the money or anything, but because of the status and the prestige and all the, you know, fabulous circles that you get to move in if you're part of that?
If you know those people, you know that most of them are boring as hell. I mean, they're not fabulous circles. They're inventions of press agents. I mean, a lot of them are very rich, but that's not very interesting either. I mean, the people I like in Hollywood are their own people. I mean, I really love Martin Sheen. I admire Rip Torn tremendously for his ability, his ideas, his independence. Martin, you know, has gone to Nicaragua. Martin's gone to El Salvador. Martin worked for me in a movie that could only get him into trouble. And not only did he do it for nothing, he insisted that he give me money. So there are people out there who are different. You know, there are a lot of people out there like Mike Farrell from MASH and Ed Asner. There were extraordinary people.
So you're not interested in...
I'm not interested in Hollywood movies to begin with. The
right.
Movies bore me. Do I really want to make movies like most of those things that are coming out there? Would I want to make a Rambo? Not for all the money in the world.
My guest is filmmaker Emil D'Antonio. He's an independent documentary filmmaker. One of the films that you're well known for is Painter's Painting, which is a documentary on some of the leading post-war artists. And there's interviews with artists and with collectors and gallery owners. And it seems that really in a lot of ways the modern art world has become like the stock market, with people investing in art and betting that this person's stock is going to go up, and if it does, that they'll make a lot of money on the painting. And, you know, the people who do very well are good at playing that particular market, which isn't to say that there isn't a lot of passion that also informs those decisions of what to buy. But for some people, it is like a stock market game. And I wonder, especially as a Marxist, how you feel about that phenomenon in the art world.
Well, I made that film because of the contradictions in my own life. You know, I thought I would maybe, in the sense of exorcise, this contradiction by making the film, because I love those pictures. Rauschenberg and Johns were friends of mine, and Frank Stella, before they had dealers or knew anything or... I mean, knew anybody in the serious in the art world, and I love New York painting, and the first part of your statement is so totally correct. I'd like to address myself to it for a moment. It has become like the stock market, but that's because it was so in France too, with going back actually to about the time of Manet. From Manet on down, then when you get to the Cubist with Picasso and Matisse, there were huge dealers. Picasso lived like a millionaire. American painters make more money now because the dollar is bigger and there are more of them around. But, I mean, everything changed. I knew Jackson Pollock a little bit. I mean, he's older, different generation. But I met him a few times, and he lived without any money. And to me, the whole thing just changed. The great symbol of that change was when the Australian government bought Blue Poles, his painting, which he sold for $8,000. At that time, it was the most money he'd ever seen in his life. The Australian government bought it for $2.1 million. I mean, by that time, he'd been safely dead a long time. I mean, he never could have understood that kind of number. What is $2.1 million? And that was already 10 years ago. The painting's worth more now. It's worth twice that. If they were buying it today, they'd be paying 4.2, 4.4, something like that.
Does that get in the way of your appreciation of art, knowing the
behind-the-scenes
deal-making and all that?
Well, I mean, the deal-making was always there. The cardinals were behind it once, the popes, the great princes of Italy and of Spain and of France, and the great lordly houses. Well, the English painting was never that interesting, really, I mean, except for Turner and a few people later. But, I mean, you know, I mean, the ruling class has the art that it wants, and we have a ruling class in this country. You know, one of the myths that we try to perpetuate here is that there's no such thing as a real ruling class. Well, Reagan is making it clearer than anybody ever did. Reagan's good for Marxists because he makes life so simple and clear. We do have a ruling class, and that ruling class has a taste for this art, so it accumulates it. And it speculates in it because it's also a ruling class that speculates in money. With money and in oil and all the other.
Did you watch your friends being changed in different ways by the money and the success they achieved when they became famous and successful artists? And I'm thinking of people like Robert Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, Frank Stella.
They were always complex, difficult, self-centered people who were brilliant. And they continue to be complex, self-centered people who are brilliant, but their vices are bigger because they have so much more money to play with. I mean, you can't imagine how much these people make in a year. If they make more money than a bank president is nothing. I mean, a bank president's a working man who goes to the office every day. Two or three of these people make at least $2.5 million a year. And that does not include the works they hold back to sell in the future and in other investments. I mean, they make $2.5 million a year selling pictures. Jasper Johns just bought a townhouse in New York for $3 million. He came from a very poor background. So did Rauschenberg. Rauschenberg's mother was a telephone operator. That's America, you know. I can't fault that. I mean, painters are different. Painters live in such a tactile, material world. I mean, writers live more with ideas. Some film people may live more with ideas. But painters live with materials, you know, with paint and canvas, and they make it, and it's there, and they need to be loved. And the only way you can love the painter is to love the work, and the only way you can express that love is finally to own the work. They're very comfortable sometimes being around some of those collectors who have 8 or 10 paintings that they've paid $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a piece for, because they know that when a person buys that number, that when he dies, because of tax reasons, he'll give them to the Museum of Modern Art or some other famous museum, and it perpetuates the whole thing, you see. The whole thing is involved with the financial structure and economic structure of the U.S. Just as painting, say, in the height of the Italian Renaissance in Florence, had to do with the social structure of both the papacy and the Italian city-states.
Through your film career, you've been out of the movie-making industry, per se, because you've operated as an independent filmmaker and you've been shown at small art houses and repertory theaters that pretty well operate outside of the mainstream. And your movies have been shown at repertory houses
and PBS
over the years.
And all TV in Europe, mm-hmm. But, except the Soviet Union.
But a lot of your movies have a new life now because they've been issued on, several of them have come out on video cassette. And I wonder how you feel about that.
I think the most amazing thing that's happened, really, it's truly a revolution. I encourage people to steal my films, buy them, and then copy them and give them away. But at the same time, what's really going on is that films are being sold now for tremendous amounts, tremendous grosses. I mean, in the year...
Wait, can I just stop you a second? It's funny you should say that, because I think in a way you can only afford to say that if you don't desperately need the money. And what I'm thinking here is that most like musicians, like jazz musicians, for instance, are so upset because their records are getting copied and they're not getting royalties and they desperately need it.
Well, you see, I make films for political reasons. I want people's minds to be changed.
Yeah.
And I don't care how they get changed. I don't want Vietnam to go away because it's, you know, it's a dark part of our history, and it's a part of our history that we better learn. We better learn what it was. So I'm happy when people take in the Year of the Pig and copy it.
Mm-hmm.
The people who put out the tapes are not happy. But it's doing so well that they're not, I mean, that was the first one that of my films that went out into tape, and it's up to 10,000 copies now at $40 a piece. That's $400,000, which for a documentary film is an amazing amount of money. And they think it's going to go up quite a bit, I mean, beyond that. This week I'm in some video magazine. I don't even know, but they took a color photograph. So it's a 2 or 3 page article about my films, and the people who distribute my films and videos say that it's going to, you know, they're going to go way up now.
So you're like a trendsetter in the new wave of documentary.
No, everybody's doing it. Everybody's doing it, and with different degrees of success. I mean, the biggest money is obviously Rambo and that kind of thing in the cassette world.
You had told me before that Martin Sheen was involved in some way in video cassettes with you. I wasn't sure what the reference was.
Martin and Rip and I was going to make a movie called Cassettes, which is about an independent film director who steals the news off the air and redoes it so that it makes sense. And which you can now do with VCR, and particularly if you have U-matic and you have decent quality. And it was a fictional film that was inspired somewhat by The Day After, that ABC thing. I even went out to Lawrence, Kansas, and looked over the place as a site to shoot. And Sheen agreed to be one of the people in it, and Rip Torn another. And I was hoping to get a woman I can't mention since she didn't say yes or no, but a star person who has politics to play a young lawyer, play a left-wing lawyer in the film. And it's one of those projects of mine that fell through. I mean, you know, if your mind is active, you have many more projects that fall through than projects that you can complete, because I was coming over in the car to your studio today, and Dan Sipes said to me, he told me this stuff about the Philadelphia Police, and I said, my God, what a fantastic script. What a really great script that is. We ought to sit down with a tape recorder and run it through, and maybe I can get some of those people in Hollywood to play in it. And, you know, you have to change the name of the city, and it'd have to be more general. It would be shot in Cincinnati, say. But it's still the same, you know, and it is a good idea. I don't mean just the move thing. I mean about the police here, because the police in America are running away with the country. It's a dangerous thing to say that, but it's absolutely true. The police are a power unto themselves in this country, the different levels of police. I mean, everybody knows what the drug enforcement people are all about. They kill people all the time. And they're also, I have a feeling that many of them are involved in the drug world. And the police here, the FBI, when I sued the FBI, I had the dean of the Harvard Law School as a lawyer. It was easy. He was a friend of mine. It cost me nothing. Nobody could have afforded the kind of suit I had, because I got 6,000 pages of documents. My crime, I've never bombed anything. I'm a filmmaker. That's the crime. But 6,000 pages of documents the documents go back to many years.
I don't mean to cut you short here, but we're just about out of time. So I wanted to know if you're working on any new movies.
No. I'm writing a novel.
About what?
It's about me. It's about something I know. It's about me and a man I knew who killed somebody for a political reason. But it's not a document. It's a novel.
Do you like the medium of writing?
I like writing. I'm pretty good at it.
Okay.
I'm not falsely modest.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your movies.
I really liked being here.
Thanks very much for coming. And my guest has been Emil D'Antonio, who's a documentary filmmaker, and his films include Millhouse, which is an ironic profile of Richard Nixon, Point of Order, which uses footage from the Army McCarthy hearings, and In the Year of the Pig, which is a study of the history of colonialism in Vietnam, French and American, and it was finished in around 1969. That's the movie that's going to be shown at the International House tomorrow evening at 7, and that's at 3701 Chestnut Street. And I can give you an information to call, a number to call for more information. That number is 387-5125, 387-5125, extension 222. And Emil D'Antonio will be there to speak with the audience after the movie. His latest movie is called In the King of Prussia, and that's a recreation of the trial of the Plowshares 8. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
It's 4 minutes to 5. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. Let's check in with Shadow Traffic and see how the roads are.